Your financial choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I am a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org or on the WDIY app. And podcasts of prior shows are also available under Public Affairs as well as on many streaming services. Today is November 20th, 2024. The markets were mixed today with the Dow closing up at 43,408, the NASDAQ down at 18,966, and the S&P pretty flat at 5,917. Tonight, random thoughts. We are live tonight. We will take your questions. Bob and Cindy are in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I will do my best to answer them. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And you can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Cindy and she'll write it down and Bob will bring it in. Or you can send questions through the email at yourfinancialchoices.com. So this is another show of random thoughts and answering any questions you have. And it's fun for me from time to time to just kind of do random thoughts, not have a specific topic, because I always feel like I have so much to say. And doing this for as long as I have, you'd think I would run out of things to say, but it seems no, I don't seem to run out of things to say. So I thought I would break it down and give a few points that just kind of popped in my head right before the show, and I thought I'll mention those. And then it's easier for me to kind of organize these random thoughts by what I call the elements of financial planning: the cash flow, taxes, investments, retirement accounts, risk management, and estate planning. So I'll break down some of my random thoughts in those categories as we go through the show. But a few things I just wanted to kind of mention off the top of my head that popped in. One random thought was about unclaimed property. So I have talked about this in the past, and I don't know if you all realize what it is or if it would even apply to you, but unclaimed property is when you may have had a bank account, it might have been a deposit at a store, a credit. It could be old securities, meaning like you might have owned AT&T stock and forgot about it. You might have had a life insurance policy that converted to stock. Could be dividend checks you didn't cash. Whatever, a utility bill maybe that you had a refund balance. It is assets of value that get turned over to the state after a period of time. And don't quote me on this, but I think it used to be 5 years, and I think it's like 3 years now. So if you don't have activity in, you know, any of these financial institutions and or places of business where they cannot contact you, or you have not interacted with your account, meaning you haven't made a deposit, you haven't taken any money out, whatever it might be that they cannot reach you to verify that it should still be active, then those institutions and or providers are required to turn those assets over to the state. And it's called escheatment, big word, escheatment. We used to just say, oh, it escheated to the state. Well, now it's much easier just to say unclaimed property. And what I like people to know is that you do not ever have to pay someone to help you find that property. As long as you have a computer, you can go online. And typically what I do is I do this randomly, since I'm talking about random thoughts, I will randomly check for clients from time to time. And you can simply Google, you know, Pennsylvania unclaimed property, New York unclaimed property, Michigan unclaimed property, wherever it may be that you had a place of abode. Or perhaps even it could be your parents. Maybe you have had parents who lived in another state. Maybe they passed away. Maybe they're elderly. Sometimes as people get older, they start to lose track of, you know, what they have, and or they forget to open envelopes, and those assets could turn over. And so you want to check in whatever states might apply, but you want to make sure that you're actually going on the state government website. So when you search PA unclaimed property, it should be a Pennsylvania.gov website. Same thing for New Jersey, New York, whatever state you're checking. Then you can enter your name. Usually there's like a CAPTCHA phrase or picture or image to verify that you're a human. And you can put your last name, and just search that, your last name, first name, search that, and sometimes even the address. And then up will pop all the names, and you can look to see if any of it makes sense, if it's your address of record, and then you can hit the claim button, and there should be instructions of how you go about doing your claim. And that could include printing out a form. It could include doing it online. It could include providing driver's license information, or you may even, depending on how much the unclaimed property is or what state you're doing it, you may have to have a notary sign off on your signature proving who you are. I had a client once who had over $10,000 in unclaimed property for dividend checks that she had not been cashing. She just had not been opening the mail. So you never know what you might find. Sometimes it's $33. And usually I know for Pennsylvania, it'll say if it's under $100 or over $100. If it is for like a parent who has passed away, then they're probably going to need a death certificate and or potentially proof that you may have been the executor. And usually when someone passes away, I do always check for those circumstances. Okay. So unclaimed property, check it out. It's kind of fun, especially when you find something. And I've had this happen a couple times even. We didn't even realize we had a credit at a store once. Apparently we must have returned something and they gave us a credit and we never went back. And there sat our check and we got that. There was, I think, an AT&T settlement once that we didn't realize we had, and or something to do with the utility bill. So you might want to check that out. So that's unclaimed property. Another random thought I wanted to mention is sometimes people forget about savings bonds that they have had or had or, you know, had for their children. Back in the day, people would get savings bonds through payroll deduction, or you might have received savings bonds as a gift for your children. So think about that. Did you have some savings bonds? Did you forget about them? Where are they? Are they tucked in a box on top of the fridge? Are they in the safe? Are they in a safe deposit box? Are they stuck in the back of a filing cabinet that you moved into the garage 20 years ago? You might want to check to see if you have any savings bonds. And if they're matured, you certainly want to take them over to the bank and get them cashed, redeemed, and then that interest income, of course, would be reportable. So watch out for things like savings bonds. If it's a joint savings bonds, maybe it's between you and your parent and you got it when you were a kid. If you go cash it, as long as your name is on there, and when you go to cash it, you give them your social security number, the income would be reported in your social security number. And sometimes those bonds aren't joint. Sometimes they're payable on death, or it's a beneficiary designation. But if they're matured again, and it's payable to you, you could talk to the parent to see whoever's name's on it, how to go about cashing it and who's going to cash it. All right. Random thoughts tonight. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning public affairs programs weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, politics, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. Public Affairs on 88.1 FM, streaming at WDIY.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Cindy and Bob are standing by. You can talk live on air with me or give your question to them. We're just talking about some random thoughts tonight. I mentioned unclaimed property and savings bonds. A little bit more on savings bonds. As a little cautionary tale, just remember, some of those bonds may have already matured, so you're not earning any money on them. So that's one reason you'd want to, you know, go check it out. And you can go on the Treasury website. TreasuryDirect.gov is what I always type in. I think you can get there a couple other ways, but TreasuryDirect.gov is what I type in. And they have a savings bond calculator that you can enter the savings bond information. If you do have savings bonds, you want to do an inventory. There's serial numbers on all the savings bonds. Those serial numbers really don't mean anything as far as the calculation of the interest goes. It just helps you keep that inventory. So you can enter it, but it doesn't matter in the calculation. What matters is the issue date of the bond and the series of the bond. And typically it's EE bonds that you would be seeing and or HH bonds. The E bonds are so old, I don't know if anyone would have those around anymore. Maybe in grandpa's toolbox. But you can value the savings bonds online and it'll tell you what the current interest rate is and it will tell you the interest to date and the maturity date. And you always want to, if they haven't already matured, you always want to wait till, like, if it's a December issue, you'd always want to wait till like December 2nd to cash it to make sure that you get that last bit of interest. But it could be very informative to you as to the interest rates, because some interest rates are like 4%, and that sounds pretty good these days. But there might be some that are much, much, much lower, and it may not even be worth holding those bonds anymore. It might be worth cashing them in to get the proceeds working for you in a more effective or efficient way. All right. So savings bonds. Oh, HH bonds. I wanted to mention that. HH bonds came about with people converting their EE bonds into purchasing HH bonds. So it gave it even further deferral. So if the EE bonds had a maturity of 30 years, you could use that back in the day. You can't do it anymore. You could use it to buy the HH bonds. But then the accrued interest on the EE bonds is stamped on the front of the HH bond. So if you look at an HH bond, you're going to see on the face of that the amount of accrued interest that has not been reported yet as taxable income. And then the HH bonds, let's pretend you bought $10,000 of HH bonds and you're getting, I don't know what the rate is anymore, but let's pretend you were getting 4%, you were getting $400 a year. That might be coming to you automatically. You get a 1099 for it and it says HH interest. Well, if that's what you're getting, you if you know what the current interest rate on HH bonds is, you could back into the value of that. And typically, the HH bonds were bought with huge amounts of interest. So when you do cash the HH bonds, which have a maturity date, and most of those, I don't recall what when those are going to be to final maturity, then you have to report all the interest at that time. Treasury interest is taxable for federal purposes, but not for state purposes. So it's a good idea to kind of look around and see what you've got. So we talked about savings bonds. We've talked about unclaimed property. Let's talk for a moment about savings rates. So I had mentioned that the savings bonds may have you know, some of those older bonds might have like a 4% rate of return. Some of them might be much lower. And I said, could you put that to better use? Well, certain of savings accounts have been offering more favorable rates these days. We might see those start to come down as the Fed lowers interest rates, but you know, the Fed might keep them steady for a while as well. So we've, in the last probably, what, couple years, we've seen much better interest rates on CDs and savings, high yield savings accounts, and better than just cash sitting in a regular checking account. So the random thought on that is, are you really getting the best rate of interest on the cash that you're holding? My husband and I, we have a credit union. We've always liked the credit union. We like supporting the credit union, but we really weren't earning anything on our cash. And we had reasons for holding cash, and I just moved some of it to a higher yield savings account. And, you know, it was quite a significant amount of interest income that we were able to get while we were holding these funds for those, you know, purposes we had to set that money aside. So lots of online savings banks that you could check out, make sure they're reputable, make sure they have good names, you're familiar with some of these names. And it's so easy these days to set up online banking to move money from your, what would I would say, your local bank account to maybe one of these online savings banks and take advantage of the higher rates the online savings banks may be offering because they're not having to pay for bricks and mortar. So watch out for things like that. Where can you get favorable savings rates? Sometimes people will go into CDs, and that could work, but sometimes you do have some handcuffs on CDs. If it's a 3-month maturity, 6-month, 1 year, 5 year, whatever the maturity might be, if you get out of it before that maturity date, then usually you have a little bit of a penalty. So sometimes it's nice to have access to just a high yield savings account because you can get the money in and out. If you have bigger funds and you're, you know, a little bit more conservative, there are also, you know, U.S. Treasury T-bills and things like that you could always check out. Interest from bank accounts and savings accounts and CDs, that's ordinary interest, ordinary income, taxable for federal purposes and also taxable for state purposes. Whereas if you're in like a federal money market account, a federal government money market account, you see those kinds of terms thrown around. Or as I said, savings bonds or T-bills, those are income taxable for federal but not for state. So sometimes the interest rate, what we call the after-tax rate of return on certain investments, might be a little bit more attractive for those options as well. So unclaimed property, savings bonds, savings accounts, and that was all about kind of finding money and making money. Let's talk for a moment in my random thoughts about credit cards. Always best not to have balances on credit cards. I don't have a problem with credit cards. My husband and I personally use credit cards all the time. We get lots of perks from credit cards, lots of points and cashback situations. So I don't have a problem with credit cards in that regard, as long as you're disciplined enough to not carry balances on those credit cards. So it's really a goal for you to work balances down if you do have them. It's quite empowering and just like such a rush to have all your credit cards paid off. Such a good feeling. So how do you do that when you're looking at sometimes almost a 30% finance charge on these credit cards? Kind of want to watch your credit, make sure you're paying your at least your minimum. I always encourage more. But I mean, if you're someone who struggles with cash flow and you for whatever reason ended up with big balances on your credit cards, you still might have a decent credit score if you're good about paying your bills. So you might be eligible to do like a balance transfer. Now, it used to be you could do these balance transfers to sometimes like a 0% interest for 12 months, 18 months, 21 months, and we still see those. But I am seeing now that there is like a balance transfer fee. I don't remember seeing that before. So you just want to make sure that you're checking out the details, the terms and conditions of any balance transfer. And then your goal would be, if you do get a balance transfer on a 0% card, is to pay a lot extra on that to get that paid off within that reward, that 0% period. If it's 12 months, try to work on getting it paid off within that 12 months. Okay. Folks, we are talking about random thoughts tonight, financial thoughts. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Sieber. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1, also on the WDIY app. Podcasts of prior shows are also available on WDIY.org and YourFinancialChoices.com, as well as many streaming services. Tonight, we are talking about random thoughts. Bob and Cindy are in the studio. If you have a question, you're welcome to give us a call at 610-758-8810, and you can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, you can just give your question to them and they'll bring it into the studio. So some more random thoughts. The elements of financial planning I mentioned: cash flow, investments, retirement accounts, taxes, risk management, and estate planning. These are the areas that are constantly swirling through my head. And let's talk about some thoughts in each of those areas. So cash flow, we were talking about finding money through, you know, unclaimed property, savings bonds, you know, savings accounts, getting better rates of return. We were talking about controlling costs, like with credit cards, avoid those high interest rate credit cards. How can we manage our cash flow if we are scared to death of the word budget? And some people can't budget. They don't like the word budget. And in fact, if you pressure them to have a budget, they spend more, you know, for psychological reasons, whatever it might be. So let's try to make this easy. Typically, or one way to do this, and I learned this at Valley National, it's called the Valley National Financial Advisors, it's called the funnel method. And if you have all of your resources come into direct deposit, if you can, or, you know, you go to the bank and deposit a check into the savings account, and you deposit all the money into the savings account, and then you want to move your monthly amount that you think you're spending over to your checking account. If you end up having to move more than your savings over of your savings into the checking account for the amount you thought you were spending, it means you're spending more than you thought. So if your receipts, your resources are 7,000 and you think you're only spending 5,000 a month, and you're like, yeah, I only spend 5,000 a month, and then your savings account should be building up and building up. But if instead you keep moving 7,000 over, then you really don't have the budget you thought you were, and that could kind of change your long-term goal planning. We have a caller live on the air. We have Ruth from Allentown. Ruth, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you tonight?
Good. How can I help you?
Well, I recently signed up for Norton LifeLock, and I pulled my credit report, and I was just horrified to see that the one number was 620 and the other number was 700. And I couldn't figure it out because I've always paid every bill on time. My mortgage was paid off early, my car loans, I don't carry a credit card balance. So as I started looking into this, it seems as if there's not enough history on my credit report, even though I've had loans for decades, because years old. And my concern is not that there's anything bad on the report, but that I do need to purchase a vehicle soon. And I'm concerned that I won't get a good interest rate with these credit scores the way they are. So I'm wondering if there's anything that I can do to raise those credit report scores, even in the short term, like taking out a short-term loan just to get more recent credit history on that report.
Very interesting, Ruth. So you're saying because you didn't have enough credit in the past, that's why they're saying the credit score is a little bit lower?
Well, that's what I was frantically Googling, and I did go to the bank to ask them, and they were suggesting that there wasn't enough history. Mm-hmm. I have had 4 car loans in my life, but the most recent one was 14 years ago, which was that has already dropped off.
And do you have a credit card that you use regularly?
I do, and I pay it off every month. So that is on there, but evidently it's not enough.
Okay.
So all the electric bill and all that stuff is all paid on time. There's not a single, you know, negative thing on the report.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I actually have not heard this before. What I have heard sometimes is people will have, let's say, credit card balances and it hurts their score, and then ways they can improve their score is to, you know, pay more down or make sure they're paying their bills timely. And it usually only takes like a few months is what I've been told to kind of see that reflected in the credit score. So, but I don't know if I would purposefully have a loan to help my credit score. You might want to, maybe you could go to, you said you were going to buy a car, right? Maybe you could go to the dealer that you think you might want to get the car. If this is like several months down the road, I might go to the car dealership and say, you know, what kind of financing could I get through you? What kind of deals do you have? And what about the credit score? Because, you know, I've had no credit and the credit score is just, you know, not where it should be for advantageous financing, only because, you know, I haven't had this kind of debt for 14 years. So that's one thing you could do is kind of ask them what might help, because it might not matter to them in the financing. If you know what I'm saying, if you go and find out from them if it matters or not, it might not matter. Because I don't think I'd take on more debt just to improve my credit score. I'm a little surprised. And I don't know if you can call like Experian or TransUnion or Equifax and get a representative on the phone or not and ask them about it. Because I also know that from time to time you can talk to the credit agency to talk about that credit score. Did you check the credit score like at each agency? Is it the same?
Well, I did pull 2 different reports. One was 620 and the other
was
700.
Yeah.
I'm not even in the good score range, much less the excellent score range, which I thought I would be in. I can definitely do that and see, because they just do not have enough credit to, you know, really evaluate whether or not I'm, you know, a good risk or not.
Yeah. But the 700 is, I think, considered okay. I think the 700 score is okay. But I would do, I'm sorry I don't have a better answer, because I've not seen this situation. But I would either, if you can contact one of the credit agencies, perhaps the one with the 700, see if you can get a representative. You may or may not be able to. I don't know how those agencies work these days. And see if there's anything you could do or what you could do to get that better score. Maybe they don't have something reflected, and maybe you could provide that information. And then secondarily, I might go to the car dealership where you're thinking about buying a car and tell them your situation and what kind of financing. And you definitely need financing for the car?
I will need financing. Okay. You know, I'll have a nice down payment, but I'll certainly not be able to handle the whole thing.
Okay.
Cash transaction.
Yeah. All right. Then, and they may have a deal. So I would check out those 2 options. But I appreciate you calling and sharing that, because this is one of the reasons I love doing the radio show, especially when people call in, because you're sharing information that I may not even have experienced. And now our listeners learn more as well. So I'll have to do a little bit more digging on credit scores and see if I can cover that on a future show.
Okay, that would be terrific. Thank you, Ruth.
Have a good night. Great question. I love when I learn something new as well. It's always helpful. And in this industry, we always have new tax legislation, we have new regulation, and we always have to kind of keep abreast of some of that. But it's these little nuances that, you know, we don't always have to face every single day. So I appreciate her time. Folks, we are at the halfway point. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We're just talking about some random thoughts tonight, so it's a perfect time for questions like Ruth had. Again, 610-758-8810. If you're not comfortable talking on air, just give your question to Cindy and she'll write it down and Bob will bring it in. Cash flow. So I talked about the funnel method. I have often had people say, well, I spend this much money. And that's where the funnel method works, when they think they're spending X amount of dollars and then you find out month to month that you're having to transfer more from your savings account into your checking account. Now, granted, you do have to factor in there are sometimes unusual payments, like if you have quarterly car payments or the real estate tax bill. So it doesn't always work out exactly, but, you know, for the most part, it's kind of a good way to budget. What else? Spend less than you make. Spend less than you make. This is a random thought. Spend less than you make. That's how you start to save money. And when you save money and you have money, guess what? You have more options. People, you have more options. And, you know, we say at the end of every radio show, be proactive, not reactive. And when you're in front of your decisions, you also have more options. But when you have, you know, cash reserves, emergency reserves, which, you know, we always recommend, it just makes such a difference in the choices that you have. So, for example, when people go to make investments and they want to invest and they might have some equity exposure, and we know in the equity markets, you have more exposure to volatility, meaning up and down. The more risk you take, the more return you're expecting to make on that investment. Well, in order to tolerate that volatility, to be able to, like, you know, stay calm when the market's going up and down and you've got that money invested and you see it go up and you might see it go down, you see it up and you might see it go down. Hopefully the goal, obviously, over time is to see it go up like an escalator. We talk about the stock market like an escalator. It's going up and the up and down is like you're going up the escalator with a yo-yo. The yo-yo's going up and down as you're going, hopefully, historically, up on that escalator. But the way you can tolerate that up and down, is when you know that you have other funds set aside for the needs that you have. And those needs might be, you know, emergency reserves. We always want that, like 6 months worth of, you know, non-discretionary spending. You want that set aside. And then you might say, oh, I want to put money into a college savings account for my grandchild. I want to take a trip and 7 months to, you know, that's going to cost $10,000. And I know I'm going to need a new roof in 3 years for, you know, $15,000. So you want to make sure that you have money set aside for those cash needs that you have, emergency and goals that you have for the next X number of years, emergency reserve for X number of months, and then a little bit more conservative investments for the money you're going to need in, let's say, 3 to 5 years. And maybe you're going to let the rest work for you in the market. But the way you can tolerate that up and down is when you know you have your other money set aside. I'll just give you a quick example. Random thought again. Someone has $1 million. They never use their $1 million because maybe they're living on Social Security and a pension. And they say, yep, I don't have any cash needs. I'm just have my pension, my Social Security, and I'm living within my means. I never need any money. And then if the market's going up and down, if they panic and say, oh my gosh, the market's down. My million went to $900,000. I want to get out of the market. I say, do you need the $1 million tomorrow? Because historically, again, over time, the markets, you know, do provide returns over a period of time. So if there's volatility, it doesn't mean you have to go all out. So just kind of keep that in mind. So I've gone from cash flow to kind of talking about investments, but they kind of all spill over into each other, these areas. But before I go completely to investments, the reason we want to talk about cash flow, again, it's so important for options that you have, but you also want to make sure if you're not retired yet and you still have control over the length of time that you're going to work, you want to understand what is your cash flow going to look like in retirement. So if you're someone who makes $100,000 and you clear $65,000 in my story, and you spend $65,000, the day you retire, you don't have that money coming in. Even net of tax, you don't have $65,000 coming in. You might have Social Security. Let's say the Social Security is $25,000. Well, I was spending $65,000. Now I only have $25,000. How am I going to make up that $40,000? Well, maybe you're going to work a part-time job. Maybe you have investments that can throw off enough money to fill that gap. So you want to kind of have an idea of where you're going to get that paycheck after you retire. And when you're in front of that decision, you have a longer runway to plan for it, to budget for it. For example, I might have someone come in and say, I want to retire today. I'm feeling old. I want to retire. I'm done. I'm 60 years old. Well, if I look at the cash flow and it doesn't look like you're going to have enough money to fund your longevity, which could be 35 years at age 60, then maybe you need to work a little bit longer. And maybe it might only take 2 more years. Maybe it only take 3 more years. And the other thing I'll tell people is, why don't you think about what that retirement is going to look like? What are your resources? And let's start living on that budget right now. So if you think you were clearing when you were working $65,000 and you say to me, oh gosh, I think when I retire, I'm just not going to be driving as much. I'm not going to be eating out. I'm not going to have those fancy clothes anymore. I think my budget's going to be $50,000. Well, if you think your budget's going to be $50,000, let's start living like that right now. If you do that for a year while you're still working, you're going to accumulate some additional money. And then we know if you can do it or not. And if you can do it or not, and your other investments and your Social Security and or pension or whatever it might be is going to feed that cash flow of $50,000, then the numbers could work. So try that out. That's another thought. All right. Try to see if you can live on that budget you think you're going to have when you retire. Let me tell you what really happens in retirement. Here again, random thoughts. I get to say whatever I want tonight. Here's what really happens. You retire. You've been working like a dog all these years. You retire, and now you're sitting in your house, and you start looking around your house, and you start saying, I haven't changed those cabinets for 30 years. I haven't painted for 20 years. That furniture that's all torn up because the dogs and the kids, when they were 2, used to jump on the couch, and those kids are now in their 30s. You know, you start noticing things, and all of a sudden you retire, and you thought you weren't going to spend as much money, but next thing you know, you need to upgrade the kitchen, you need to do a remodel, you need to paint. And then you think, oh, I'll do it myself. And then you realize, wait, are you going to climb that 15-foot ladder to do the foyer that goes up 2 stories? Maybe not. Now we have to pay someone to go do the painting. What about the landscaping? Let's rip out those bushes that we did, you know, 15, 20 years ago, now that you have to dig 4 foot in the ground to get it out. Oh, can't do that either. Got to pay someone to do the trees. So just, you know, be in front of your decisions. Think about this. Try to visualize it. Maybe try to take care of those things while you're working. So particularly for the listeners who are like maybe in their 50s, start taking care of that stuff right now. Because let me tell you, you get older and all of a sudden you feel a lot different. So that was cash flow, just kind of paying attention to that. Investments, sticking to the discipline and diversification. So be really disciplined. Try not to be emotional in your decisions when you're doing investing. And diversification is key. It's the most important thing, not picking the next hottest stock. The most important thing is diversification and sticking to a disciplined and you know, makes a big difference. Take the emotion out of it. And Also, another random thought, pay attention to the asset geography. I talk about this often. I've talked about it for as long as I can remember. I was talking about it before anybody else was talking about it. I think because, you know, it's the accountant in me. Asset geography, know how your, and I'll go into taxes here a little bit then, know how your assets are taxed. Understand. So if you have retirement accounts, like IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, those come out ordinary income, pensions, Social Security, all ordinary income taxable, ordinary income subject to ordinary income tax rates. Investments, when you have investments outside of your retirement accounts, that's could be in equities. We could see qualified dividends qualify for a lower tax rate. That's why they're called qualified. Then we have capital gains, long-term capital gains qualify for a lower tax rate, not short-term gains, long-term gains. So if you needed to raise money and you looked at your portfolio and you saw something that you hadn't held a year, it was, you know, 363 days, for Pete's sakes, wait till 366 days, because then it'll be long-term and the capital gains get taxed at a lower tax rate. So the geography issue is, let's have the equities in our non-retirement accounts. And if you have to have fixed income, if you push that into your retirement accounts, that's ordinary income. Fixed income is interest income. I mentioned that earlier. And that gets taxed at ordinary rates regardless. You know, so if money's coming out of an IRA, ordinary income. If it's in fixed income, ordinary income. So I like to see the tax-favored treatment in the non-retirement accounts. Obviously, you're still probably going to have some, you know, savings accounts and some bank interest or CD interest in your non-retirement money because you have to have cash flow. So you might still have a little, but look at your tax return. I'm always talking about how your tax return tells a story. I love looking at tax returns because it really does tell a story. It tells us how someone manages their cash flow, how well they're investing, are they putting money into retirement accounts, and if you look at it, you can see if you have qualified dividends and capital gains and things like that, and you'll see if you have tax favored treatment on it. In fact, you could have a mutual fund and it could throw off $10,000 of dividends. And if you look at the qualified dividends on that same amount, if it's like $1,000, that tells me you think you're in a mutual fund, you think you're getting paid dividends, but it's mostly fixed income in that mutual fund. So it could be a mutual fund that's really like geared toward preservation or a conservative portfolio. So watch for that. Not all dividends are created equal. So when we talk about investments, we also talk about managing risk. There's risks with investments. I just recorded a show last week to run next week on risks in investing. And we talk about interest rate risk, market risk, inflation risk, diversification risk, concentration risk. So that'll be interesting if you want to learn more about risks in investing. Retirement, I already mentioned, while working, pay attention to, you know, saving outside of retirement accounts. I've had people who save everything in their retirement accounts. Then when they retire, every time they need money, they have to take it out and it's ordinary income. So it's always a good idea to try to balance your investing, not just in retirement accounts, but outside of retirement accounts. We call that non-qualified. Or if you have the opportunity to fund Roth IRAs, those grow income tax-free. There are some, you know, qualifying distributions. You have to make sure you're following the rules on that. It's no longer a 5 years or age 59 and a half, but you can always take out your original contributions. So that is Roth funding. That's another way to kind of diversify your asset grab in retirement if you need money to kind of manage income taxes and or cash flow. Folks, we're at our last break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services, including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Are you planning on getting rid of your car? Why not donate it to a good cause? WDIY accepts donations of used cars, trucks, vans, motorcycles, and other types of vehicles, even boats, and the proceeds will support your favorite programs. WDIY's vehicle donation program makes it easy to give. The pickup is free, and your gift is tax deductible. For more information, call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or visit wdiy.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. Phone number 610-758-8810. You can also send questions through yourfinancialchoices.com. Retirement. Let me also mention, when we talk about retirement, I'm typically talking about retirement accounts and ways that you can save while you're working. So, but I want to preface this by, you have to understand kind of cash flow needs and income tax and investments when we're talking about retirement planning and retirement accounts. While you're working, and I always tell people, young people particularly, if you're going to apply for a job, you want to make sure you understand what all the benefits are. And one of those benefits could be employer-sponsored plans, meaning if you go to a certain employer, they might not have a retirement account option for you, and therefore then you may not be saving for retirement the way you should when you're younger. So you want to make sure that you understand if that's a benefit that they would offer. The number two benefit would be, if they do have the employer retirement plan, do they put in an employer match if you put money in? So if you say you're going to put in 6%, maybe they put in 3%. Maybe if you put in, you know, 10%, they'll only put in 3%. Understand what the match might be, because that is free money. So an employer match is free money. You want to understand that part of it. Then you also want to understand what the maximum amount is that you can put in. If you have two jobs in 1 year, you got to be careful. You can't, you know, there's a max for the year. I think it's $23,000 for 2024 with an $8,000 catch up if you're 50 or over. You can put up to that amount, but maybe you don't have that much and you could just do $5,000, whatever it might be. You get a deferral. You don't have to pay tax on it if you're doing it on a pre-tax basis. This is where you have to pay attention for a second. If your income is low and you might only be in a 12% tax bracket, maybe you're just out of college, you're just starting, you're excited about this new job opportunity, you're going to make $40,000 a year, and they offer an employer plan and they're going to put in a match. If they offer a Roth option, which is a designated Roth, as part of the 401k, then you could put money into the Roth, but you don't get a tax deduction for it today, because maybe you don't need the tax deduction. Maybe you're in a very low tax bracket. You don't need the tax deduction. And now you have money sitting in an account that's going to grow income tax free. And the beautiful thing is, if, let's say, in 5 years you change jobs, you could roll over that Roth money and you can always get access to the original contributions, as I said earlier. But if you don't need it, it can continue to grow income tax free. So that is through employer plans. If your employer, and so low income, I love Roth. Higher income, I love the regular 401k for the tax deduction today. That's the deferral method. It's defer, and you know, you don't have to pay tax on it today, but in the future you would. But I really like a variety of savings options for yourself. Let's say you don't have an employer plan available, then there's always the option of doing an IRA or a Roth IRA. Outside of that, the issue there is the amount that you can contribute to either of those is so much lower than what you could do through the employer plans. The Roth IRA and traditional IRA are at $7,000 with a $1,000 catch-up. But if you have no other plans, then yes, you can still do those. But there's income limits on the Roth IRA, and there's also income limits on making a contribution to a traditional IRA if you're already a participant in an employer plan, or if a spouse is a participant in an employer plan. And if your spouse isn't working and doesn't have earnings, there are spousal contributions that you may be eligible to make. Again, there's income limits. Too much to go over, you know, in this random thought show, but just be aware, lots of different saving options for people. whether you have employer-sponsored plans or you're doing it on your own. And there's also something called a backdoor Roth IRA. Anyone, no matter what their income is, as long as you have earnings, can do something called a non-deductible IRA. Typically, the non-deductible IRA would be for people who already have an employer plan or their income is too high to be able to do that and a traditional IRA or Roth IRA. So the non-deductible IRA, you can put money into an IRA. You don't get a deduction for it. Now I have cost basis in that IRA. Well, if I don't have any other IRAs, because all my retirement is in my employer plan, I don't have any other IRAs, I could convert that to a Roth and not pay any tax on it because I, you know, it was after tax money. I didn't get a deduction for it. I put in $8,000. I have basis of $8,000 and now I'm going to move it into my Roth. It's called backdoor because if my income is too high to fund a Roth on my own, that is one way to get money into a Roth. For many years, I was sure the IRS was going to close that loophole. I wasn't into, recommending that to clients because I thought, oh, the IRS is going to close that. Well, they didn't. And in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, they practically endorsed it. So, yes, that is an option. But it really only works if you don't have any other IRA monies because the IRS looks at IRAs all as one. So you might think you have an IRA that you just put that $8,000 in and you have $1 million IRA, you know, at a different firm. Doesn't matter. The IRS looks at the IRAs all as one. So if you think you have $8,000 basis, yes, you do, but you have $8,000 basis in the entire IRA of like $1 million. So now if I convert that $8,000, I'm actually paying tax on almost that, you know, whole $8,000 conversion. All right. So a little complicated, but there you go. Another make sure people know about once you reach age 70 and a half, you could do something called a qualified charitable distribution where you make cut a check directly out of your IRA to your favorite charity and you don't pay income tax on that. Still get a tax reporting document. Then you have to, you know, let everybody know, your tax preparer or your software know that you did a qualified charitable distribution and then it's not income taxable. But you could do that at 70 and a half, just not a day before, by the way, but 70 and a half. And you can do it from inherited IRAs. So I have had, we see, you know, people living longer. And now we have clients whose parents are passing away. Maybe the parents were like in their 80s and maybe you're 68, 69, 70. You're not required minimum distribution age, but now you've inherited this IRA. Well, at 70 and a half, you can do a qualified charitable distribution from that IRA. You would have your own required minimum distribution from an inherited IRA, but you can also do, fulfill that using a qualified charitable distribution. And there's a lot of flexibility in the amount you can do. You know, it's like up to $100,000 plus this year. You can do as much as the RMD, less than the RMD, or up to that $100,000 plus. You don't have to wait till age 73. That is the new RMD age, by the way, 73. And for people who were born 1960 or later, your RMD age is 75. So they're pushing that out a lot further. Those IRAs could grow to be a lot bigger. And guess what? When your kids or your whomever, niece, nephew, friend inherits that IRA, they're going to have to take it out within 10 years. They accelerated the distribution for non-spouse beneficiaries, other than certain exceptions, minors, disabled people, certain as someone less than 10 years younger than the decedent. So there's certain exceptions, but for the most part, non-spouse beneficiaries will have an accelerated required minimum distribution within 10 years. And it doesn't mean it's 1/10 a year. It's based on your life expectancy for those first 9 years, which could be a much smaller amount. And then in the 10th year, you have to take out the balance, the whole thing. So there's lots of planning around the inherited IRAs these days now. Lots of planning, meaning you want to make sure that you're considering the tax consequences. I'll give you an example if I can quick. Let's pretend I inherit an IRA from mom and it's $100,000, and let's pretend my required minimum distribution is $2,000. So I take out the $2,000 because I'm still working. Maybe my income's really, really high. I'm only going to take the minimum amount. So maybe I take out the minimum amount year one, year two, year three, year four, year five. Maybe that totals about $10,000. And I said the IRA was worth, I forgot, I'll pretend it's $100,000. Now I still have year six, seven, eight, nine, 10. Well, now I might want to take like one-fifth to kind of even it out, smooth it out, so that in the 10th year, I'm not taking out $100,000, which could throw me in a higher tax bracket. It could throw me into higher Medicare premiums. It could throw me into net investment income tax situations. It all depends. So you want to do some planning around that. All fun stuff. So we talked about cash flow. We've talked about random thoughts on that, investments, retirement accounts. I've touched on taxes throughout this as well. Make sure you understand tax brackets. I'm always surprised when someone thinks because they're in a 22% tax bracket that they're paying 22% taxes. I prefer to look at what I call the effective tax rate. So I look at the taxes over your taxable income or even over your page one income, because you'd be surprised. You're not really paying that marginal tax rate. That's what I like to call those marginal tax rates. The tax rates, you know, practically zero on, you know, because we have a standard deduction. And then we have 10%, 12%, 22%, 24%. We're not getting into the 32% bracket, at least for, I think, like married people until you're at like practically $400,000. So the tax rates right now are still fairly low. And it doesn't mean that you're paying that marginal tax rate across all of your income. It's just on that marginal amount over those various brackets. And you can Google those to look those up. But be aware of how the different income is taxed. I already touched on that a little bit. Risk management is insurance. Always just kind of make sure you have the insurance coverage that you would need. Check your policies. Talk to your agents regularly. Make sure you have the coverage. Watch out for tort. Liability on cars. Sometimes people think they don't need tort. Well, if you have a passenger in your car, if there's some kind of accident and there's liability, if you don't have that tort coverage, then you may not be able to get the full claim that you might be entitled to if both parties were injured in that accident. If you have a house, depending on where you live, do you have sinkhole coverage? Do you have flood insurance? Do you have, sewage coverage? Whatever it might be, and to also protect your personal valuables, rings or musical instruments or special art collections, whatever it might be. Make sure you have that coverage. Umbrella insurance. Umbrella insurance is not that expensive, and it kind of gives you an umbrella over, your auto and homeowners. Estates. Random thought here, not a random thought, something I talk about all the time. Make sure you have your estate documents. Critical, critical, critical. We've had shows on that. You can find those in the podcast under Public Affairs on WDIY or on Your Financial Choices. Estate documents, your will, your power of attorney, healthcare directives, living will, possibly a trust. You want to make sure you have those. Do not leave it to random. Do not assume your spouse is going to get everything. That is not necessarily the case, depending on what state you live in, depending on what other heirs are alive, parents or children. Spouse may not get everything. So spouse, if you're listening, make sure you go have your documents done. Align that with your beneficiary designations. Work with a good attorney and your financial advisor to make sure that it all coordinates and it all works together. And that if you have charitable intent, you want to do that in the smartest way as well. That's why I love IRAs for charitable intent, because those are income taxable to whomever gets them. Thanks, Bob and Cindy, for being here. Thank you, Norm. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Ruth, for calling in. Next week, we're going to have a pre-recorded show on risk-taking. Enjoy your Thanksgiving. Remember, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices, and have a great week.